Happy to see you.
All right. Good evening. My name's Tara. I'm alcoholic. And oh, sorry.
Sorry.
I'm scarred for life. I saw Patio walk up to a speaker one time in a meeting when she was like chewing gum and she was like, spit it out in my hand. I'm scarred for that. Anyhow, okay. It's good to be here tonight. Welcome home to the newcomers. Congratulations to those who took chips and happy birthday to those who are celebrating a birthday with us tonight. I want to thank Tim for being my 10 minute and for moving my dresser today. I text him. I'm like, I've never needed your help more than right now. And I've needed his help a lot in my time. So this was a big one today. But in any case, so every time before I speak, I ask God to help me deliver his message. And the reason for that is because my message is that apart from God and Alcoholics Anonymous and rooms like this and people like you, I'm a colossal failure in every area of my life. And so I'm going to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'll just get right into that now that the, oh, I have a sobriety date. I thought it's important. I have a sobriety date. It's 11:30 of 2001. I have a sponsor. Her name is Duffy, and I have a home group in Yorba Linda, California, at the Ohio Street meeting. Yeah, so I'm a drug dealer and a prostitute by trade, and I just want to break the ice with that. Yeah, thanks. Woo-hoo! Where else could that be celebrated? You know what I mean? I grew up in Orange County, in the beautiful city of Santa Ana. It's beautiful somewhere in there. I come from a long line of alcoholics. My dad was alcoholic, his dad was alcoholic, and so on. I have an older sister who works for Garden Grove Police Department and a younger brother who right out of high school did a tour of duty in Iraq. They're both genius caliber students. My sister has like a master's degree in criminal justice, you know. I feel like I do too, but not really. And then my brother like double majored at the University of Chicago in like economics and political science, you know, just like stupid shit, you know. And then there's me, and I am just an absolute disaster, just an absolute alcoholic disaster. And I believe for me, I was alcoholic long before I took that first drink. I was just chronically ill at ease and maladjusted, and there was just a degree of separation between me and you. And I was just overly concerned always about what you thought about me, and primarily me in general. And so I grew up on the street in Santa Ana where all the kids my age were boys. I grew up a tomboy. Those boys taught me how to drink and cuss and fight and like stick my thumb through a Budweiser beer can, shotgun a beer, how to weigh drugs, you know, important stuff, you know, that a young up and coming alcoholic needed to know. And the first time I took a drink, I was 13, and I desperately, like Tim talked about, like I desperately needed a drink, man. Like I really did. And I drank and we got drunk. And I fell down and I had a great time. But what really happened that day is I finally felt okay. Like for the first time that I think ever, like I finally felt okay. Like the playing field was leveled. I no longer cared about so much what you thought about me. I felt great about me at that point, you know? And I felt like what any normal person feels on like any given Tuesday, basically. And, I never drank in moderation. There was never any desire to like control and enjoy my drinking. Like I knew from the beginning there was no controlling my drinking, you know. And so I never I don't like the feeling of buzzed or like mildly intoxicated. Like even right now, talking about being buzzed, it's like irritating. I feel irritated even thinking about like having a little cocktail with dinner. Like that is not my goal, right? It's like it's like bad sex, you know what I mean? It's like, all right, I guess. Like if that's what you got, you know, I'll take it. But you know, that's not what I'm aiming for, you know, but so it just progressed very rapidly for me. There was never like I said, there was never any desire to moderate or control my drinking. I can tell you that what I should have told you in the very beginning is that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I literally have a crush on AA. Like I'm super smitten with this program. And had I known that I would be speaking from a podium on a Sunday night, right, when I was 13 and they handed me that marijuana cigarette, I would have politely declined, right, and been like, no, thank you. I have to maintain a singleness of purpose on a Sunday night in Laguna Niguel. Cannot do that. But I could not foresee that, right? And so my disease just progressed very rapidly. I can tell you that there was never a substance presented to me where I was like, oh, no, I just don't think I could, right? Like I was like, yes, I want that. Of course I want that. I want more of that, and I'm gonna take your share of that as well. And so, there's just, like I said, it progressed very rapidly. I mean, I just went through the whole gambit, you know, of every type of substance there is, and including PCP. And I don't know why I just thought of telling you that, but it's because I'm from Santa Ana and I was talking about PCP earlier with somebody. I don't know why, but it was like a big thing in Santa Ana, right? So, PCP. I would do that during my physical education class in high school. Like we'd walk around this park at Centennial Park in Santa Ana. It was a continuation school, and that was what we would do for like our PE class. I was physically fit, so I was taking big steps that day. Anyhow, I digress. So it just progressed super rapidly. By the time, you know, by the time I was 15, I had a fake ID. My name was Lisa Simpson, and I'll just tell you a little bit really quickly about what my drinking looked like. So I found this group of people that drank like me and hated like me and fought like me and were just like me. I mean, just like it was like a whole group of like Tims, right? And so, we were this we were these like little Orange County punk rock kids, and we would go to this bar in Costa Mesa called Club Mesa, and we would go see punk rock bands there when I was really young, like 15. And so just to give you a brief idea of what it looked like, I would arrive at the bar, and the bouncer at the bar, his name was Paul Taylor, and he was of sordid character. Pretty sure he had just been released from prison. And you might want to take a look at your drinking when, like, you're 15 years old, your name is Lisa Simpson, and upon arrival to the diviest dive bar in Costa Mesa, the bouncer, right, wants to give you a moral pep talk on how you should conduct yourself that evening, right? And so, he'd be like, Tara, can you just like maintain yourself? Because I have I have this problem when I drink, and it's called my mouth. And either one of these two gentlemen in the front row will attest to the fact that that is my problem sober as well, but one of many. Thank you. And so he'd be like, Tara, can you just maintain yourself tonight, man? Like, I really don't want to drag you out in a headlock again. And I'd arrive at the bar drunk because we called that pre-gaming. And really what it was is I didn't want to spend my money on alcohol at the bar that I had already allocated for narcotics. You know, I had like a kind of budget, you know. And so I'd be with some dude, you know, and I'm that girl that you guys probably know very well that you take to the bar, and she's like, you got something to say to me, you're gonna say it to him, and the whole bar wants to like beat you up, and then Paul's dragged me on a headlock, and I have this signature move when I drink, and this is it. I like to jump out of the vehicle at the red light. I see you, girl. I see you. And then I like to start a fight with the driver of the vehicle, right? And it's like after the bar is closed, only people out there are like us and the police. And I like to like rip the windshield wiper blades off and like smash the windshield, you know? And dude's like, get back in the car. I'm on parole. I'm gonna go back to prison. And I'm like, good, fine, go already. You know what I mean? Like, bye. I've already been talking to your homeboy for 4 weeks. See ya. Because that's my dating demographic. I date in inmates, and I would like wait I would like wait outside the parole department, you know. I just hung out there, you know, and it was like hometown buffet, you know, and that's what it was like. And that's when it was still good. That's when it was still working, you know. It got progressively worse from there. And what started to happen, by the time I was 18, I was severely addicted to alcohol. And what started to happen by that point is I just began to devastate the lives of anybody who came in contact with me. I just began breaking the hearts of anybody who cared about me. And I was just drinking to die, one may say, at that point. And I remember towards the end, like what happened is I ended up on the streets, I ended up in hotels, I ended up just like the 1 year guy with the tie, by the way, nice vest. I mean, come on, that is a very nice vest. I don't even know where you're at. Where are you? I don't know where he went, but he had it. Did you take the I am so disappointed. I'm not even going to talk to him. Put the vest back on. But like I was you know, I was like on the streets, just you know, out there doing it, you know. And my parents were woken up by the Orange County sheriffs on two separate occasions, kicking in their front door. They were woken up by loaded firearms to their head because they were looking for their little alcoholic daughter. And the reason for that is that it's so inconvenient to appear in court when you're struggling. You know, it's just such a huge inconvenience. And I was like, catch me if you can, you know. And then the weird thing about that is that they do every time, you know, every time. And so I remember towards the end, I would just pray, God, please just kill me in my sleep so that I don't have to wake up and live another single solitary day like this. Just please don't let me suffer here any longer. And the insanity of this disease is like the next day when I was in this truck with these dudes that I had robbed last week, who were definitely going to get what I owed them this week, parked up along a block wall, unable to exit the vehicle. I'd pray, God, please just get me through this one. Please just get me through this one. And I mean, there's been a multitude of various, you know, instances similar to that out there, you know, running the streets of Santa Ana. So yeah, it got really awful. And my dad had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, but like his alcoholism looked much different than mine. He would go to work and bring his check home and take care of his family. He's a bar drinker, but we both arrived at the same place, which was a place where the strongest desire to stop was of absolutely no avail. By that point, the drugs and alcohol were dictating my every single move. It didn't matter if I wanted to get home to my dad's birthday celebration. Didn't matter if I wanted to be a loyal girlfriend. Didn't matter if I wanted to stay out of jail. Like my wants and my desires were irrelevant at that point. The drugs and the alcohol were going to tell me where I was going, who I was going to be. I remember sitting in a hotel one time and looking around. And I'm like, I don't even like not one of these people here. You know what I mean? But like, I'm going to need them for something, so they're going to stay. And my dad put me in contact with his best friend Jeff H, and he was my Eskimo. And Jeff's alcoholism looked like mine. Like his alcoholism spoke to my alcoholism, and he was the first person to tell me about the disease of alcoholism. And he had a message of depth and weight. And I went into detox for the first time at the age of 21. I went to a place down here in South Orange County. Casa del Cerro was the name of it. closed since then, but that's where I went, and I started to hear the message there. I was violently ill. This was my first separation from alcohol. I didn't sleep for probably over 30 days. I had convinced myself that I was having a heart attack. I was not. I was just detoxing. I had to wear like this heart monitor while I was there, and was wild. I don't ever tell that part of it, but I do remember I was in like the druggie buggy. I was in treatment and we were going to a meeting and I had this like heart monitor on and I had to like push a button every time my heart was like rapid. And I actually got in a fight in front of the meeting with this heart monitor on. It was like, but I made it. So that's the good news. But anyhow, so I heard the message at Costa del Cerro for the first time. The H&I panels would come in. They would deliver this message of hope, and I could not stay sober. I just could not stay sober. I would hear them, and they would talk about like getting a sponsor, working the steps, getting a higher power, going to meetings, right, helping the still suffering alcoholic. And I'd think like, wow, this program's great for somebody like Tim, who obviously needs it, like that guy clearly needs it, but like, what's it gonna take for me, And so, through a series of extremely painful relapses, the first time I tried to get sober, I was 21, and I didn't obtain permanent sobriety till I was 25. So I was in and out, and in and out, and in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I've told you, like I've had a lot of horrific experiences out on the streets. I've been violated and victimized in every conceivable form or fashion. Truly. But those 4 years of going in and out and in and out and in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous were by far the most painful times of my life, because with every failed attempt, it just confirmed what I already knew, which was, you really are just a piece of shit, Tara. You're not getting sober here in AA. You're past the point of redemption. You're past the point of God's love, and you are gonna die cold and alone in the alley in Santa Ana. And I love in Bill's story where he says, I knew it, and I welcomed the idea. And towards the end of my drinking, like I was a dangerous person, not because I was like some gunslinger or anything like that, but because in the end, it was just like, what are you gonna do to me that hasn't already been done, right? Like I had a death wish. I was like, please do something, help me, put me out, put me down. And what happened for me is I met some fine people in these rooms. I met this one woman named Paula. And Paula was a dope fiend hooker from Midway City. And she would call me when I was drunk at my parents' house. And she would say stuff like, Tara, when are you coming home? And the beautiful thing about Paula is that her love for me was not contingent on my sobriety date, right? Like she loved me no matter what. And she would, it was back in the day where like there was no caller ID, you know what I mean? So like, it could be the connection, or it could be Paula. You know what I mean? Like it was a risk. It was a gamble. You know what I mean? Like it was like, oh, I was like, please don't be Paula. Please don't be Paula. Paula. I'm like, damn it. But that woman was my absolute angel. And what happened for me is on Thanksgiving Day of 2001, I called another member of Alcoholics Anonymous up. Like I said, this was just I was that girl who would come into the meetings and you'd be like, man. Like that poor girl, like what's it gonna take? Like what does her bottom look like, That was a weird thing to say from the podium. Sorry. That was strange. So I called another member from Alcoholics Anonymous up on Thanksgiving Day and he came and picked me up literally on the curb in Santa Ana. And he was like, all right, Tara, I'm going to take you to Stanton Detox, a lovely place. If you have not been there, I encourage you never to go there. And so he's like, Tara, I'm going to take you to Detox, but you don't have anything on you, right? Because I'm on parole, because that's what I call. And I was like offended that he would accuse a woman of such high moral fabric. You know what I mean? Like, how dare you? Like, who brings drugs into detox? Like, me, I do. Every time, I do. Because, like, that sudden withdrawal from alcohol, it's like it's inhumane, right? It's like I much prefer like the taper, you know what I mean? Like every alcoholic loves that word, the taper, where I'm just going to do a little bit less every day until I'm all the way off of alcohol, right? It sounds good. I mean, like it looks good on paper, but that was never successful for me. And so on my way to detox, with alcohol concealed on my person. I said this prayer and I said, God, if you help me just this very last time, I promise that I'll tell other people what you've done for me. And I went into detox and I drank because I had to. And that was the last drink I had instant detox. My sobriety date's 11:30 because it was all kind of a blur, so I just picked a date far enough out to make sure that I was sober. And then I went into Woodglen, went to a 90-day treatment center in Fullerton, and I don't think there was much different this time than any other time. I was broken and battered and desperate and hopeless, and thank God, because from that came some willingness, from that willingness came action, and from that action came permanent recovery. And I can tell you that every time prior to that, when I told the people that loved me and cared about me, I'm never going to hurt you again. I'm never going to drink again. I meant that with every fiber of my being. I meant that wholeheartedly. Like, I could have passed the polygraph. I could have put my hand on a stack of Bibles as if Christ himself was across the room and said, I swear I'll never do that again. After what just happened, there's no possible way that I could ever touch alcohol again. And that insane idea would come and it would win out. It would win out and it would tell me things like, you can probably just smoke weed, Tara. Come on. Or like, you could drink. You know that you definitely have a problem with narcotics, but you can probably drink. Or like, just a multitude of lies that I would believe, right? This inability to see the truth, right? I went to this treatment center. This woman, Paula, was working there at the time, and she was like, okay, you want to get into treatment? This is what you're going to do, Tara. She's like, I know the program director. This is what you're going to do. You're going to go up to the program director and you're going to tell him that you're willing to do anything to stay sober, even if it means sleeping with him. And I was like, what? Like, this is my treatment plan. I'm going to trick the program director. Okay, awesome. And so she's like, just do it. She's like, it's funny, you'll get in. I'm like, okay, all right, bro. Like, I was just already so dehumanized anyhow. I was like, whatever. And so I was like, really, Paula, this is what I'm gonna do. And so I like started walking away, and from the hallway, down the hallway, she's like, you've done it for less anyhow. I was like, great, okay, thank you for that. So I walked up to this like big old like convict program director dude, and I was like, hey, I need to get into your program and I'll do anything, even if it means sleeping with you. And he was like, what? Like, where do you come from? I'm like, Santa Ana. It's like a barter system. Can I get a bed or what? And he denied my advances that day. And then I ended up marrying him and having three kids with him, like, way further on down the line than like divorcing him and all that stuff. And that's like my Al-Anon mom's favorite story, so I got in, and I got a sponsor, and her name was Lily. And what Lily brought to me at that treatment center was hope. And she told me, Tara, it doesn't matter what you've done, where you've been, how many times you've tried this, you got a shot here in Alcoholics Anonymous, kid. And I go, look, Lil, unless God comes down from the heavens above and plucks the desire to drink out of me, this program's not going to work for me, because I felt like I wanted to disclose that to her, because I knew I was going to disappoint her the way I had disappointed everybody else in my life previously. And I told her that, and she looked up at me and she said, Tara, that's precisely what's going to happen. And I was like, oh my God, I hate you people. And I'm here to tell you that that's precisely what happened. Somewhere along the lines of working the 12 steps, I was put in contact with a power greater than myself. I had a spiritual experience that was sufficient to bring about recovery. And the most important thing I'll tell you tonight is that the very first time that I worked the 12 steps in order with a sponsor that had a working knowledge of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober ever since. And it could be some freakish coincidence, right? Like, oh my God, that's so weird. You worked the 12 steps in a 12-step recovery program and you achieved sobriety. Trippy, right? Like, it was just so weird. And so I started working the steps with Lily, and by the time I was ready for my inventory process, I got Paula to be my sponsor again, and I did this fifth step with Paula, and there was nothing that I hadn't done that Paula hadn't done, you know what I mean? And so I did this process with her, this fifth step process, and at the end she's like, Tara, have you omitted anything? And I was like, no, Paula. She's like, no, really. Like, have you? Because we're building an arch through where you shall walk a free woman at last. And I was like, I don't even know what that means, but okay, there's this one thing. And so, like, I told her that one thing, and And she was like, "Oh, honey, I've done that too." And I was like, "You sick bitch. Like, you can't sponsor me. How are you gonna sponsor me? Like, that's weird. Like, you should probably leave my sober living, you know?" And what really began to happen that day is I began to trust another woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was like the slate was clean. And I knew that, like, I never again had to be that woman written down on those pages ever again. And frankly, like, I never wanted to be to begin with. You know what I mean? But like I said, the drugs and alcohol were dictating exactly who I was by that point. I continued on with the steps, and I started making these amends. And by that time, my dad had like double digits in AA. My mom had double digits in Al-Anon, and I made this amends to them. I did exactly what Paula told me to do. Like, I just followed her direction, laid it out. My dad was like, "Oh, honey, we just want you to be sober." And I was like, "Yay, I love AA. This is great." And then my mom was like, she had like an itemized invoice of everything I had ever done since birth. You know what I mean? And what really began to happen is we began to like recreate our relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad like self-appointed himself as my service sponsor, and so he was like that old timer who would be like, "What are you doing on Thursday?" And you're like, "Oh my God, think of anything, because if you don't, you're going to like Tehachapi." You know what I mean? Like, you're going to Edelonto. You know? And so we he told me, "Terry, you want to sum up service in four words? It's get in the car." And I was like, "Okay, like, I'm getting in the car." And so I'd get in the car, and we would drive like 4 hours to Delano State Prison to do an hour panel and like drive 4 hours back. And it was me and my dad and this dude, Plumber Jim. And Plumber Jim told jokes, right? And they were b bad jokes. It wasn't like the good joke you told. It was like a bad, they were bad jokes. I'd be in the back of this car, I'm like 25, and then with these guys who are like 600, you know what I mean? And I'd be like, "Man, what is my life? It's a Friday night, you know what I mean? And I'm like in Tehachapi, right? And what is going on here?" And I can tell you that, like, those were some of the most divine moments of my life, was on the road with those gentlemen, you know? I can tell you some of the most spiritual moments that I've encountered have been on a maximum security penitentiary yard. And I would get this idea that, like, "Oh, I'm going to go deliver this message of hope and redemption to these poor incarcerated souls," right? My big fat ego. And I can tell you that another beautiful paradox of Alcoholics Anonymous is that every time that message of hope and redemption was delivered to me from those inmates. And I remember this one time, this guy Todd, he's our friend, he shared in a meeting on the East Yard in Chino. He said, "I have a life sentence. I'm never getting out, and I've never been more free." And I was like, "Wow, like, I guess I'm not going to complain about the 91 traffic today, right?" Like, it just puts things into perspective. You know what I mean? Service work keeps me small enough to fit inside of God's hand. You know, and I'm forever grateful for the fine examples that came before me of service. Our good friend Vic was one of them. And so what happened is my life gradually began to change, and I found a God in this program. Like I said, I just kind of felt like I felt like a hypocrite approaching this God. Like, I was like, "Hey, I'm that girl, you know, can you forgive me? I've been doing all the things I shouldn't be doing." And I just kind of felt like a hypocrite. And you know, I let go a lot of that guilt and that shame in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned what God thinks about me here. And thank God for that, because if I know what God thinks about me, then it really doesn't matter what like Linda in the Tuesday night meeting thinks about me. You know what I mean? It really doesn't matter. Thank you. And I can tell you this, that about 10 years ago, my dad got sick with cancer, and I would go over to his house every day on my lunch break, and I would help my mom with him, change him, bathe him, turn him, do all those things. And I would think, "Tara, don't go over there today. Like, it's just too hard. It's just too hard. Don't go over there." And but you people taught me how to act better than I feel, and you people taught me how to show up no matter what, and how to train my feet. And so I did that. And when he took his last breath, there was nothing left unsaid. There was nothing like, man, I wish it could have been this, or I wish I would have been that. We were square, right? Because of what you people had shown me, right? And so my sponsor tells a story about when she was driving across the desert, and she was on the back of a bike with her husband. This gnarly storm started coming in. They were like trying to outrun the storm, and she started like questioning her own mortality. And she was like, if I die right now, am I good with God and all of his people? And that woman was able to answer yes, you know. And today, because of you guys, like, I think I'm pretty close, maybe. I'm good with God and most of his people. I'm good with God and all of his people. Now, all of his people may not be good with me, but you know, that's not my business. I can tell you what this program has given to me is it's given me peace. It's given me joy. It's given me three beautiful children who have never seen me drunk or loaded. It's giving me a fellowship, which is indescribably wonderful. I love what it says on page 152 of the book, where it talks about, have you a sufficient substitute? Like, what do you guys have for the new? What does this program have for me, the newcomer? Like, what do you guys got? It says, yeah, we sure do. It's vastly more than that. It's the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and here you're going to commence shoulder to shoulder on this common journey together. This is what I found here. This is where I found Tim. This is where he comes and moves my dresser. Oh, you're gonna stop. Oh, you're gonna pay attention now that I said your name. Okay, good. So yeah, that's what I found here, you know. And I can tell you a couple of quick stories. One is that there was this old timer, Bob Husted, when I got sober, and he was just this crusty old dude who like smoked Camel non-filters, and like his fingers were all crippled, and they were like yellow. I'm not kidding. You can ask Brandon back there. And they were like yellow from the nicotine, right? And he would like suck his teeth like that and talk to you. And so like I was this little whippersnapper, you know, coming in. And I remember I got a year sober, right? And Bob was that old timer who could like suck the joy out of the room. You know what I mean? And I'm like, hey, Bob, got a year sober, right? I was so proud. And he was like, when you're done patting yourself on the back, why don't you put that hand out to a newcomer? I was like, okay, bro. Okay. That's what I'm gonna do, you know? Yeah, and he also said, you know, Tara, takes 5 years to achieve emotional sobriety. And I was like, weird, but okay, whatever, Bob. So I come up to him like 5 years sober. I'm like, Bob, 5 years, I'm emotionally sober. And he was like, it's 10 for you. I was like, what? How do you change the AA rules like that? You know what I mean? Like, how's that even possible, right? And one last quick story, and I'll tell you, like, I always wish that like I was really good at something. I was never good at anything, really, you know. And I always like was so envious of people who had like spiritual gifts. Like, you were gonna like you're like a really good, you know, you can play the flute, and you're a really good artist, and you're a great athlete, and you're a good pianist. Pianist with a T. And I was like, well, I wonder what my spiritual gift is. You know, I didn't really get anything. And because of you guys, you know, I found my purpose. You know, I know what my gift is, and that is that I have an endless capacity to love. And it'd be great to play the flute and all. I really like to, but like I guess I'll take endless capacity to love, you know. And I know there's a lot of people who are here, thank you, who are in treatment. I've been in so many, and I know what it's like to be I know what it's like to be separated from my people, and I know what it's like to feel alone. I know what it's like to feel scared. I know what it's like to feel hopeless. I know what it's like to feel like this just isn't going to work for me, you know. And I can tell you that there's at least one person out there tonight Who their very last thought is going to be about you and how much they love you and how much they want you to come home and be sober and be the brother, the nephew, the niece, the mother, the sister, the daughter that we know you can be, right? The woman or the man that that we have become in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell this last story and I'll end for the night. I can tell you that I found 1,000 ways to fail in Alcoholics Anonymous. I always thought we had this like preordained destiny, right? Like you're gonna be a doctor and you're gonna be a pilot. I hate you. Tim goes with me every time I speak, so he could like literally recite my pitch. So he's like doing that right now. This was gonna be a good one too. Now he just ruined it for you guys. So I'm not even telling you. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I thought we had this like preordained destiny. You're gonna be a nurse and you're gonna be a pilot, and you're gonna be a doctor. And like I just felt that God had bounced the dopamine hooker card off of my head. He's like, that's what you get, chick. Like, deal with that, you know? And I found 1,000 ways to fail in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can tell you that. I didn't come to AA and become like a super virtuous type of gal overnight. I'll tell you this last story. I was like 7 years sober, and I had just delivered my son. And I was a lunatic. I was crazy. And this woman that I sponsored, her name is Kelly. She's like one of my best friends in the whole wide world. Kelly and I got into a fight on the phone. And Kelly told me on the phone, she said, bitch, come get some. And I was like, okay, I think I will come and get some, in fact. And so I like handed the baby to my mom, like, I'll be right back. Gotta go. And so I like went over to Kelly's house, like sideways on the front lawn, like, and Kelly was on the phone. Unbeknownst to me, it was the Anaheim police, right? Because I'm from Santa Ana. We don't do that, right? I was like shocked. And she went inside the house and locked the door. And I was like, but wait a minute. Like, I've come for some. And you asked me if I wanted it, and now I do. I'm already dressed for some. And so my head was like, you should probably kick in the front door and get some, you know? And so that's exactly what I did. It was like the beginning of Cops, like, ooh, bad boys, like that. And I kicked in the front door, and the cops showed up. And the reason I tell you this story is because I kicked open the front door of a woman's home who I sponsor. I tell you that because if anyone's looking for a sponsor, I got it. I'll show up. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for letting me be here tonight.